Voilà ça. This morning we'll return to settling the mind in this natural state. But it may be helpful for a little while to step back from the specific method, get a bit of a larger framework or perspective. I like the big view, the zoom lens going into wide angle sometimes. And the wide angle view, the large view, is that what we're encountering now from the Buddhist worldview, what we're experiencing, what is rising up to meet us in terms of just the appearances, the events that take place, what happens to us. This is a result for us in samsara. These are the ongoing flow of consequences of what's called impure karma, or matapele. It's just so seeds have been sown, and we're just harvesting, appearances arising, things happening to us. But of course, that's not the whole of it. Because as I mentioned, that's kind of one wave coming our direction. But then there's another wave, to use that metaphor from yesterday, that image, another wave rising up to meet it. And this is the powerful current or wave of, in Tibetan, bhakcha, or vasanas in Sanskrit, habitual propensities, our old habit patterns. In the Pali tradition, Theravada tradition, they'll more commonly refer to it as samkaras, or samskaras in Sanskrit. Just our habitual ways of engaging, understanding, interpreting, labeling, classifying, understanding, and making sense of what's going on. And so with the perpetuation of these habitual propensities, all pretty much saturated by delusion, craving, and hostility, and some nice virtues thrown in once in a while, with the meeting of those two, then we have a perpetual motion machine that it just never stops. Because what we're adding to it keeps on just throwing, every time we engage with this, with the old habitual propensities, more wood is thrown on the fire, more impure karma is generated, and it goes on. And the bad news, it goes on it forever. That's the bad news. I mean, really, actually, forever. It never stops, right? All by itself. It doesn't just say, oh, gee, I'm tired of this, and then just kind of fizzle out. It just keeps on going and going and going. So what's the escape strategy? Well, there are multiple ones, happily, and one of them I introduced just before this 8-week retreat, and that is this whole strategy of lojong, which is shifting attitudes, shifting propensities, shifting the way we interpret, make sense of, and so forth, whatever's taking place to us. So we're just not locked into the same old habits, but can start to reconstrue, reconfigure, reinterpret, review what's occurring to us. And so even negative karma, that is, so the ripening of negative karma in these two ways coming together, can actually be viewed in such a way that the experience turns out to be transformed into the path conducive to your own flourishing, your own genuine happiness. Even though what's coming from outside is negative karma ripening, because what we bring to it transmutes it, and it's as if we're getting ripening of good karma, but it takes some real active intervention from our side to shift things in that way. Extremely worthwhile. So there's this whole range, the Bodhicaryavatara, the Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, and many, many other Buddhist teachings in the Theravada, Mahayana, and so forth, traditions are all about shifting perspective, developing new propensities, new habits that are really beneficial, rather than simply falling into the same old ruts of the old ones that have pretty much gotten us to where we were the day before this retreat began. And then there's another strategy. And that is, this is kind of like a head-on collision, right? I mean, two waves coming together. Wave of habitual propensities, wave of impure karma manifesting, and then trying to work out something there on that level. And then there's another way of doing it, and that is just letting the floor drop out beneath. So whatever's arising, especially in meditation, but this really pertains to the whole of all the appearances arising, whatever's arising, we simply attend to them without distraction, without grasping. And without distraction means we're not just caught up in the same old ruminations, the same old perpetuation, but without grasping means we've stepped out of the dance. When we engage in lojong, we're changing the dance. We're changing the footwork. We're changing it from a tango to a waltz or whatever, but we're changing the nature of the dance because we're bringing something new to it on that level. And now we're just stepping out of the dance. And say, I don't really want to participate on that level anymore. I'd rather just recognize all these appearances, simply arising as appearances, but not try to change how I'm responding to them. My response to them is going to be just presence, And that's not really a habit. It's something different. So this is what we're doing in settling the mind in its natural state. We're not trying to reconfigure how we habitually react and react and react, because we can react in very beneficial ways, or the old rut ways, or just be present. And then in so doing, recognize the sheer emptiness of all the appearances arising to the mind, and in the broader perspective, recognizing the sheer emptiness of all that arises altogether. In which case, it looks like we're going for the end of the game and not simply modifying the game. Now, I mentioned some days ago, that, now this is specifically for those of you here and listening by way of podcast, who are already involved in Vajrayana practice. Okay, now specifically for such people. I mentioned that it can be very, very helpful, very empowering for this practice, very liberating for this practice, just before you enter into the shamatha practice per se of settling the mind, of engaging Guru Yoga, imagining the Guru as indivisible from all the Buddhas, imagining the Guru coming to the crown of your head, dissolving to your heart, and your body, speech, and mind becoming non-dual from the Guru. So whether you think of the Guru as Manjushri or Padmasambhava or Tara, whoever it may be, or the Dalai Lama or Dingo Kenzi Rinpoche, some great Lama, but the whole point there is to really radically shift the perspective from which you are attending to the events taking place in the mind. So as a straight Mahayana practice, or Theravada practice for that matter, we're seeking to view the events taking place in the mind simply from the perspective of the Bhavanga, or the substrate consciousness. Right? But when we bring in the Guru Yoga to this, then really as we imagine the Guru's mind dissolving indivisibly with our own mind, then of course we're seeking to view what takes place in the space of the mind from a much deeper perspective, which is nothing other than Rigpa. Right? But now, what I didn't mean when I suggested that is that, for example, if your focus, if your object of devotion, refuge, and so forth, let's imagine, is Tara, feminine embodiment of the enlightened compassion. What it doesn't mean is, okay, visualize Tara and then dissolving into yourself, visualize yourself as Tara, imagine that you are Tara, and then holding that thought, then observing whatever arises in the space of the mind. Because then you're going to be doing something a bit complex, and that is you're going to be holding a visualization, which means you're holding on to it, holding a sense of identity, I am Tara, holding on to that. In the meantime, you're going to practice observing whatever arises in the space of the mind without distraction, without grasping. Well, you can't, because you're grasping onto, you're identifying, holding the sense, I am Tara, and maybe even some background visualization. So that's not what I meant by that, because then you're kind of not doing either practice. That's not full-fledged Tara practice, because that's a whole practice in and of itself, nor is it settling the mind, because one is bringing in this great big addition. But rather in the sense of what I mentioned a day or two ago, of a practice being imbued with bodhicitta, chanchukisemgi zimba, nyenjungi zimba, that your practice is imbued with a sense of renunciation, imbued with bodhicitta. So you arouse this, if it's in renunciation, arouse a powerful motivation to gain liberation, and you reflect upon that, you arouse the aspiration, the visualization, whatever you do, and then you go into settling the mind, and of course you leave that visualization, and you're not thinking, I want to be liberated, I want to be liberated. That's in the background. It's gone subterranean, right? So it's just there, it's implicit. But when you're doing the practice, you're just doing the practice, right? And likewise for bodhicitta, and likewise if you are developing practice of Tara or Guru Yoga. You do that at the beginning. You imagine this dissolution, this indivisibility of the Guru's mind with your own, making that very explicit, and then you just let it go. You let it go implicit, and you just focus on the practice. Okay. So there are multiple ways of breaking through this confluence of the rising of maturation of impure karma, not necessarily negative karma, just impure karma. Impure karma simply means all the karma that's accumulated that is tainted by delusion, craving, and hostility. That's impure karma, especially delusion. That's enough. And so this wave, so we've looked at two ways of breaking through that. And of course, one of the deepest ways that really prepares you for Dzogchen practice per se is the stage of generation practice. Let's just focus on now, let's say, the male manifestation of Avalokiteshvara. And what this entails then is attending to appearances and recognizing the appearances that are simply arising as consequences of impure karma, and they're empty appearances. Appearances of your body, appearances of the environment, other people. And recognizing how, as we commonly make sense of, interpret, tell ourselves stories about what's happening to us, other people, the environment, and so forth, we're always choosing a story that is one possibility. And we often have the sense we've chosen the one right story. You know, just like religious fundamentalists everywhere, but they're not just other people. We get an interpretation. We get a way of viewing, a way of, okay, now I get it. And we get a lock. Now, this makes really good sense to me. Person behaved in such and such a way. Ah, I get it. This is the motivation. This is why they did it. This is what's going on. Okay, I've got it. And it's a lock. We feel we got the right answer. And then we reify it. And we make it the only answer. And we make it objectively real. That's just one whole exercise in psychosis. Because it's never true. It's never true. It's never the one absolutely true truth. It's never absolutely objective. It's always you, me, you, me, you, me. It's always the interchange, interface between subject and object. So it's never true. But we lock onto it, just desperately trying to make sense of the world, and not only the world outside, but the world of ourselves. Who am I? Who am I? And then we come up with a story. We come up with an interpretation. We come up with a sense of, this is who I am. And it makes sense. It seems to, like scientists, it seems to, how do you say, make sense of the data, the appearances. Okay, this is who I am. And then, and so out in the middle of the desert, we create a prison. And then we lock it from the outside and then throw the key away. This is who I am. This is who I am. We lock ourselves into it. So to see whatever story we're telling ourselves about ourselves, other people, the environment, what's taking place geopolitically and so forth, it's always a story. And conventionally, it may be right. But conventionally, there are so many stories that are right. And some that are wrong. And some that are partially right. But they're all just stories. And no one of them is the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And that goes for ourselves as well. And so as we sit in meditation and we see this sense, this where, you know, we jump over to awareness of awareness. Who do you think you are? Who is this agent? Who is this observer? And something comes to mind. And see, it's just an appearance. It's just a habitual appearance arising. And it's empty, utterly empty. There's nothing really there corresponding to that empty appearance. With that insight into the emptiness here, subjectively, the emptiness there, objectively, that all the stories and all the appearances are empty of anything substantial, tangibly, inherently real. In that emptiness, then by the power of imagination, deeply rooted imagination, in that emptiness, there is Buddha nature. And from that Buddha nature, we may invite it. We may invite it. Gurwa in Tibetan. Invite. Manifestation, embodiment, appearance of a Buddha, an archetypal form of the Buddha. Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, Tara, whoever it may be. Invoke that. And recognize, since there's no one else here, it's kind of like we have a vacant apartment. Because the person we thought was living there turned out to be just a ghost, an apparition, no substance, no reality, any more than just what we impute to it. So we stop imputing it. Stop imputing it even conventionally. And there's an empty apartment. But it's saturated by Buddha nature. Out of that Buddha nature arises yourself as Buddha. Sustaining that sense of identity, still conventional, but rooted in reality, that identity is called divine pride. Sustaining that cuts through all the habitual propensities, and it cuts through all the impure karma, like a flaming sword. Just cuts it. You don't need to work with them one by one by one by one. It just cuts through it. And reality is being viewed from a radically different perspective. So, this morning we'll attend first to the body, recognizing whatever is arising there in terms of visual appearances, mostly tactile appearances, those are the ones that many of us care most about, especially as we get older. I think when you're younger, you care about the visual. Am I handsome? Am I pretty? Am I fat? Am I skinny? And when you get older, it's just like, how much do I hurt today? I wish I could hurt less, because the handsome days are finished anyway, all gone. If there ever was a day, it's fading quickly. But if I just don't suffer too much physically, that'd be nice. And the tactile sensations, the somatic sensations, just arising in space, attending to them without distraction, without grasping, neither I nor mine, then to the space of the mind, neither I nor mine, and be free here now. Be free here now. That would be good. Find a comfortable position. Un lasso. Enjoy your day.